Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting the final interview in the continuing interview series with Dr. Maria Clave, pioneering world-renowned computer scientist, president of Harvey Mudd College, board director of Microsoft and Broadcom, past keynote speaker at the World CIO Forum, past dean of engineering and professor of computer science at Princeton University, former vice president and dean of science at UBC in Canada. Maria, you're an icon in so many domains where your innovations and accomplishments have laid foundations in science, education, leadership, innovation, and research. As indicated earlier, this is the last in an interview series where we explore your considerable history from your early years and into your professional life of notable distinction, significant outstanding contributions in a number of fields, including societal causes. So thank you for sharing your considerable expertise and deep accumulated insights and wisdom with our audience.
It's my pleasure, Stephen. It's always a joy to talk with you.
Now, I just want to bring the audience up to speed here. We've done just a remarkable series of interviews detailing your past history, and we got into a really interesting situation. I'd allocated 2 hours for the final interview, and we found that we've only really got into half of that final interview in those 2 hours. So the purpose of this session here today is to complete the, you know, sort of exploring the remaining parts of your remarkable past. And earlier we had talked about the things that inspired you as a child and your years at university and your years in industry and so on. And we also talked about in the last interview your time at IBM Research and at UBC, the University of British Columbia, and the things that it led you to move to Princeton, and then what you did at Princeton University, and then why you took on your roles at Harvey Mudd and what you hope to accomplish at Harvey Mudd. We also talked about your research interests at the University of Toronto, the University of British Columbia, Princeton, and Mudd. We talked about some of your good and challenging experiences during your latter or later academic career and how they influenced you. And then we finally talked about your mid to current career path and how you would describe yourself, you know, your aspirations, your approach to societal contributions, your family, friends, and so on. And then we left it there. So I'm going to continue now on that journey with this next question, and that is, can you further describe those years and several pivotal moments that shaped you?
I think one of the things, as I look back, that I really learned is, number one, I love to build things. I love to work with a community and create something new that wasn't there beforehand. And one of the really big things I have learned is, if you're going to build something, do it in a place where it actually can last. And, you know, I think one of the big lessons from building a department at IBM Research, it's mostly gone now. I mean, there are just a handful of people still in that department. The department still exists, but we used to have 25 researchers. Now it has 8. And I look at the difference between that situation and the situation at UBC, where the computer science department is just absolutely thriving. And it's still driven by the same sort of set of values it was that we collectively created and starting in 1988. And, one of the things that I think I've learned is that in academia, partly because academic institutions last for a very long time, but also because academic institutions, to a large extent, the culture is set by the individual faculty who make up a department or a school. And so if you build something with a set of values that the faculty actually own themselves, it will last, because they will tend to hire people who have similar values to that, and so it will last, you know, long past the people who built it. And, you know, Harvey Mudd College is just a great example of that. The vision that created Harvey Mudd College is really very much that of the founding president, Joe Platt. And, you know, he died a couple of months ago, and, you know, all of the founding faculty are no longer there. I think most of them have died now. But the mission of the college is still the same, and it's owned by all the current faculty at Mudd, and I'm sure the mission of the college will be the same 100 years from now. So this whole idea of, you know, if you're somebody who likes to create things, think about where you create them and you know, what kinds of cultures and traditions can be in place for a very long time. I think the other thing that I've really thought a lot about, and is the importance of interdisciplinary approaches to find solutions for important problems, and how necessary it is that we educate people who really can collaborate across disciplines, because virtually every societal issue that faces us is—it's not going to be solved by just a technical solution or a scientific solution. It's going to involve, you know, culture, economics, anthropology, and many other things. And so it's also one of the reasons why I love being at MUD, because it has such a strong commitment to educating students who can do exactly that. And then, you know, the final thing I'll say is, and, you know, have really, this is something that has become much more apparent to me as I get older, there's just this big difference between what your day job is and what your life goals are. And it all works a lot better if you pick your day job to be something that helps you move forward with your life goals. And, you know, I have a number of life goals, and I think much more intentional about thinking about what I do next in terms of what I want to achieve with my life. And, you know, it felt like when I was younger, there were lots of opportunities, and it was almost sort of random which one, you know, which research problem one worked on. I mean, it was just, it would be the place you work on the problem where you got some traction, and you know, which job one takes. I mean, I think at the time when we chose to go to IBM Research, I think, you know, we had good reasons why we made that choice. It certainly made sense for both Nick and me at that stage in our career to make that choice. But if I had known now what I knew about it, I mean, I had no idea what a pivotal role the access to management training at IBM would make in my life, and that's something I'd be deeply grateful for. So just this, and, you know, one of the things I spend an enormous amount of time on is mentoring other people as they're going through different, you know, stages in their careers. And it's something that gives me enormous pleasure, because what I know is happening is, one, I'm learning from them. I mean, every single person I mentor teaches me something about what it's like to be, whether it's a graduate student or choosing your career in industry versus academia, or deciding whether you're going to become a manager for the first time. But I also feel like it's just wonderful to be able to give people a broader framework to look at these decisions in. And because even though I've been very fortunate to have many wonderful mentors in my life, I never felt like anyone could paint as clear a picture of what the options were as I feel like I can do now for younger people.
Yeah, it's interesting. You mentioned that you're taking perhaps a more considered approach when you look at new goals. So you've accomplished so much. What sort of items do you have in your kind of bucket list of life goals?
Well, I mean, the overall life goal is to fundamentally change the culture of science and engineering so that it becomes more supportive of people who are not the norm. And, you know, I've had the joy of working on that, you know, at UBC and then at Princeton and now at MUD. And I think that at some point in my career, I want to be the leader of a major research university. I do love being at MUD, but it's sort of, you know, there are certain set of things you can influence being president at MUD, and then there's other things that are harder to influence because MUD is not a major research university. And so, you know, I'm not sure that it will happen, but one of the possible things I might think about doing at some point would be that. And, you know, it'll be absolutely fine if that never happens, but it's definitely one of the things that, you know, I think would be interesting. I mean, just, you know, four summers ago, when I started to think about the possibility of going on a major corporate board, and, you know, that it turned out to happen and then happened again, and it's been an incredibly interesting educational experience. And so, you know, I think about the possibility of at some point leading a major research university, but maybe it'll happen, maybe it won't.
Well, that's fascinating. And it seems like everything you set your mind to, you always achieve it. So I'm sure it's going to happen. Now, after your time with IBM, what other industry contributions did you make, and what motivated you?
I'd say, when I moved to UBC, one of the things that I started to do, IBM actually paid my salary for my first year at UBC. In fact, it paid the salaries of both myself and my husband. we were technically on a sabbatical leave from IBM, and they did that as part of making a contribution because the provincial government at that point had a matching program in place, and so it the provincial government matched it, so it was, you know, ended up being, you know, worth several hundred thousand dollars to UBC, and in exchange for that, I agreed that I was going to work with IBM Canada to help basically build their university relations, and worked with the Toronto lab for several years working on that, and it was just a wonderful experience. I mean, I got to know a lot of people, a lot of the executives in IBM Canada. I got to know the various leaders of the lab as several people held that position, and I also got to help build really a much more cohesive network of computer science departments across Canada through using sort of IBM as one of the pieces of glue to make it happen. So that was definitely something that that I took a great deal of pleasure in doing. I then, in around 2000, I decided to do a startup company, and I had a number of friends who were doing startups in the States and who were becoming extremely wealthy. And my goal for doing this, it sounds ridiculous, but was the whole idea was, let's do a startup, and if we become significant, if it's successful, we will give 10% of the money we make to the University of British Columbia. So it was sort of an effort to do fundraising in a different kind of way. And so I started a company called Silicon Chalk with Murray Goldberg. Murray Goldberg, who's a very good friend, was the founder of WebCT, which was the first sort of web-based course development software. And it was eventually bought and by another company, and then eventually was acquired by Blackboard. And so Murray had left WebCT at this point and was thinking about doing something else. And he's got to be, you know, like one of the most interesting, intelligent, nicest, smart entrepreneurial people I know. So, you know, we did a round of angel, of raising funds from angel investors, and then we were able to get two rounds of funding from GrowthWorks in BC, which is a government venture fund. And the idea behind Silicon Chalk was that we create software so that if all students in a class had laptops or computers of some sort, they could they basically could get an annotated recording of whatever went on in class, the questions that were asked, what the instructor said, you know, what the instructor wrote, all of these kinds of things, in a way that made it really easy to sort of share information with other students, to do assignments and so on. And the problem was, you know, when we got ready to market it, was there had been a move that was actually IBM had championed, getting a number of universities to give their students laptop as part of what they got for tuition. And Acadia was the lead university in Canada that was doing it. And a number of colleges and universities were doing it in the States. And the problem was that movement eventually just went away. People started bringing their own laptops, and, you know, the idea of an institutionally provided computer just disappeared. And our software, which was probably, you know, a decade ahead of its time, because now everybody has a laptop at most colleges, and now would be a good time to have that software. But we went under, you know, due to lack of revenue after 5 years. And I have to say, you know, it's always extremely painful to do a startup that fails. And of course, 90% of startups do fail. But there was so much learning out of that experience. I mean, the whole in our heyday, we had 22 employees. Murray was CEO. I was chair of the board. I learned a ton about writing business plans, about raising money, about equity, about just all kinds of things. And Murray has gone on to do a number of startups since then. He currently has a startup that he's self-funding called Marine Learning Systems, where they're providing both online and support for training for the maritime industry, and BC Ferries is one of their clients. And I suspect it's going to be very successful. But, you know, just you learn a lot by getting engaged in this kind of thing. At the same time as Silicon Chalk, I also went on the board of another company that started at the same time called Brightside Technologies. And this was a company started on some technology that came out of the lab of Lauren Whitehead, who's an applied physicist at UBC. And the idea was you could use this technology to create displays that had a much higher dynamic range than typical displays. And so I was on that board until it was acquired by Dolby. And so that was a startup that actually, you know, had a good exit in terms of what happened to it. But it was very interesting watching the different dynamics of being on that board and the dynamics of being on the Silicon Shock board. And, you know, I feel like I learned a tremendous amount about what to do and what not to do from both of those experiences. Both small startups, you know, both interesting technology, both great technical people involved with it, but just very different dynamics in terms of how the boards worked. And then, you know, the next thing I want to describe is the experiences of partnering with IBM for 5 years with IBM Canada with the ANSERT chair I held for Women in Science and Engineering in BC and the Yukon. And again, you know, it was during that time, that five-year period, we did a whole bunch of joint projects with IBM. And, you know, for example, we did annual large-scale events for usually girls in eighth grade about information technology and, you know, what they could do with it. And the thing I learned from IBM, which sounds totally trivial, but it is so, it's so true, prizes really matter. Competitions and prizes and giving out, you know, swag. So, you know, like, whether it's a pen or a comb or a nice bag or something like that, it was just so interesting. It would never have occurred to me to do it, but, you know, I think companies know a lot about marketing, a lot about getting enthusiasm and attention that I absolutely didn't know. So, you know, obviously since then I've, you know, been involved with now two public company boards, Microsoft and Broadcom. I've also... I do a fair amount of speaking at companies about how they can recruit and retain more female engineers. And it's always very interesting to see the interplay between the tech culture in companies and what it means for their female employees. And I've had some just interesting conversations with folks at Google and Facebook about how, you know, how they see their culture and how outside females see their culture. And so, you know, I would say I probably give talks at probably around five companies a year about this issue. And it's hard to tell whether, you know, it's actually, whether I'm actually having impact, but it's certainly an interesting learning experience to visit different companies and see what it's like. One of my favorite examples was I was invited to come visit Jane Street Capital, which is an arbitrage company in New York with about 280 employees, and it's extremely successful, and they have about 9% women. And they just wanted to talk about what they might do to have more women. And as I was walking around their building, their offices, I noticed that there were posters from World War II everywhere that basically showed, you know, Rosie the Riveteer, but more often showed men in helmets firing weapons. And I literally every wall was covered with them, and I asked about them. And, you know, apparently one of the founders, his father had collected a bunch of these, and then the founders, all four male, decided they liked this theme and, you know, decorated the whole office. And they said, well, you know, as a female, I don't really like war images. And, I mean, I'm probably not the only, probably other people don't like war images either. And I'm surprised that you would choose that as your decor to decorate a place if you're interested in recruiting more women. And the founder I was talking to just said, oh, nobody's ever raised that issue before. What a surprising idea. And I was just sort of going, what? You know, you've been around for 12 years and nobody has raised this issue. So, you know, it's just, it's fascinating to see just how often companies that are very largely male in their technical employees are pretty clueless about what might be attractive or less attractive to recruiting women.
That's interesting. You know, I was a speaker at the ISACA World Congress, and I had an opportunity to speak to one of the women leaders there, and she talked about some of the issues and challenges, and just fascinating, I guess, the bias, and either conscious or even unconscious bias, and just how that shapes people in many respects and puts all of these, I guess, barriers up. But you've been working really hard to remove those. So.
Yeah. And, you know, it's just very interesting. I mean, I was, I think people are a bit more open now than they were, say, 10 years ago. And, but it's, you know, I think it's one of these things. I hope to see it really change in my lifetime, but it's going to take, no single person is going to do it. There is no silver bullet. It's going to be a whole bunch of people working on it persistently over an extensive period for things to change.
You know, both of us were at the World CIO Forum, and you were the keynote speaker there. And, of course, there was a challenge there, and it shocked me.
Yeah, that was really surprising that they did not want to have a talk about recruiting more women into IT careers. That was just so interesting that the Chinese officials would think that was so controversial.
Right, or that perhaps there'd be some kind of backlash from the audience as well, right?
So, yeah.
And it was quite the reverse, right? There was a lot of interest.
No, the audience really liked it. I mean, they, and the organizers seemed very happy afterwards with how it went. It was just a really peculiar experience.
Now, earlier, you know, you talked about your entrepreneurial career. You know, you talked about Murray Goldberg and Silicon Chalk, and then being on the board of Brightside. And it's interesting, I interviewed one of the founders of Brightside many, many years ago, so I can relate to that conversation. And of course, you sit on two boards of Fortune companies. Is there any more that you want to add to your entrepreneurial career, the good, the bad, the controversial? You know, for example, you did indicate that when you were on the board of Silicon Chalk, you learned many things, and then you were on the board of Brightside and you learned other things, but you also learned what to do, what not to do. Can you share any of that?
Well, you know, one of the complications about being on the Brightside board was that for most of the time, I was actually not present in Vancouver. And so I was on, and I was appointed by UBC because the technology came out of UBC. They had the right to become, to have a seat on the board. And Lauren had initially been on the board, but when he became provost at UBC, it was seen as a conflict of interest, and so he went off the board. And there was some real difference of opinion among some of the other board members about, things that I would say were basically legal or illegal. And it's very hard being the lone voice in, you know, arguing against something when you're on the phone and everyone else is there face to face. And so I learned that the right thing to do was simply to ask, I mean, we had a lawyer, not on the board, but a lawyer for the company, simply to ask to get a legal opinion, on some of the things that were being suggested. And sure enough, the opinion would come back and say, well, no, we can't really do that. And, it was just, I had to learn how to basically use things other than, you know, sort of just rational argument to get things to happen, because, you know, it was clear that in the view of some of the other board members, I was just a nuisance. You know, I was there because I was put on the board by the university. I often run into, people don't think I have any business sense because I'm an academic. I mean, I run into this over and over again in my life that, you know, people meet you and they're just sure that, you know, everything, all of my opinions are based solely on my academic experiences, so therefore they have absolutely, you know, they're not going to have any validity in the business world. And that was definitely the way I was treated. And then on the Brightside board, and then eventually what happened was they added another board member who had a great deal of experience in this particular space. And I just, and this guy was completely sane, completely, you know, made total sense. And all of a sudden my life got so much better because he was there face to face, and, you know, we were always on the same side of every issue, And the difference was that the other board members really respected him because he was by far the most experienced business person on the board in this particular technical space. And it was very funny. I finally got to meet him and face to face after we had been acquired by Dolby, and there was a celebration dinner. And I went up to him and said, "I'm so grateful that you came on the board. I just felt like I was, you know, one of five and always the odd person out until you came on." And he said, "Oh, believe me, I was really grateful you were on the board too, because we were two of five, but at least we were two." So it was just an interesting experience. And, you know, I would have resigned from the board pretty early on if I hadn't felt the loyalty to UBC. And, you know, Lauren, as a very good friend and colleague, and, you know, he really, he and a number of the technical staff felt very strongly that they really needed me on the board, so I stayed on. But it was just interesting.
So from your entrepreneurial work, what enduring lessons still shape you today?
You know, I think there's a couple of things. One is timing really matters. I mean, that was, and I think this is one of the reasons why, you know, so many companies fail is that, you know, like, for instance, MySpace, you know, was a really hot thing for a while, but, you know, Facebook had a slightly different approach and ended up, you know, really taking over the space. And there's also, you know, if you're going to do something that really has a big impact, you're probably going to start working on it well before you really know what the timing is going to be. And so there's this big issue of luck as well. The other thing I've really learned is pick the people you work with very carefully. One of the rules we had for Silicon Chalk was, the people that we, you know, hire at Silicon Chalk, they have to be the kind of person you would want to marry or want your child to marry. You know, they have to have the same value system as you do. And, I think that's really true for, particularly for startups. It's also true, you know, I mean, one of the things I totally love about my job right now at MUD is that I have a team of six vice presidents and, you know, and Kelly and Karen, who Karen's director of the president's office, also secretary of the board. And I love every single one of them. I mean, they're the kind of people I want to spend my life with. And, that's just life is too short to work with people that you don't respect and value. And, so it's one of the things that I think very hard about when I take on a responsibility, whether it's on a board or deciding to do a joint project with a group or whatever, is make sure that it's a set of people that you really share your values with.
Do you have any additional entrepreneurial aspirations for the future?
Well, I have one that I enjoy collaborating with startups, and I have one amazing initiative that I'm doing with a 12-person startup in Palo Alto. So the startup is called Piazza. It's founded by a woman named Pooja Sankar, who did a computer science degree at, I think it was IIT Kanpur, and was one of three females in the computer science major. And, you know, felt very shy and very isolated and, you know, then went and did a master's degree in computer science at the University of Maryland and, again, you know, felt pretty isolated. Worked at Facebook for a little while, I think a couple of years, and then went to do her MBA at Stanford. And she had this idea that it would be just great to provide an online platform where students could study together, work on projects together. And, you know, particularly for classes where there are hundreds of students in a course, you know, providing this opportunity for students, even if they're shy and female in a largely male class, to get to know each other would be, you know, a really great opportunity for students. And so, Piazza does exactly that, and they have, I think they've had maybe about 250,000 students, at, you know, various universities across North America. Use their software. And Pooja had this crazy idea what if we, rather than actually doing class, we actually had a mentoring initiative for female students in science and engineering. So Harvey Mudd College and Piazza are partnering on something called Wits On. So WITSON. And WITSON stands for Women in Tech Share Online. And the tagline is, it's better to have your wits turned on than off. And we are going to run this course for 5 or 6 weeks starting October 1st. We already have, I think it's 23 colleges and universities signed up to be lead institutions, and they're, you know, sort of the people you would expect. So Stanford, Berkeley, MIT, UIUC, Georgia Tech, Olin College, Cornell, several other of the UC campuses, UBC, the University of Toronto, et cetera, et cetera. And the idea is that we will collect, we will allow any student, male or female, to be nominated by a faculty member to participate in this course. We will collect questions, mentoring questions that the students have. Each week there will be a lead mentor. We call it, my tongue-in-cheek name for them is celebrity mentors. So our first one is Mae Jemison, who is was the first African-American astronaut. The next one is Jackie Barton. I think the next one is actually going to be Julie Larson Green, who is the number two person leading the Windows 8 team, and I think the highest ranking technical female at Microsoft. We have Jackie Barton, who's won the Medal of Science, National Medal of Science in the U.S. last year. She's head of the Chemistry and Chemical Engineering Department at Caltech. We have Julie Scheimer, who's the CEO of Welch Allyn. I'm going to be one of the mentors. And so the idea is at the beginning of each week, the lead mentor for that week will answer a number of questions that have been collected from students the week before about, you know, asking for career advice of various kinds. And they will be videotaped answering these questions. And then we'll have, you know, hopefully maybe around 30 support mentors who will be women at different stages of their career. So everything from graduate students through faculty members through corporate vice president through somebody just starting the first job, et cetera. They will also be commenting on the questions and answering questions and so on. So it's going to be this huge mentoring fest. And it's been so much fun working on this because it's just like the sort of standard response from I have been contacted. So our MUD's job is to organize the mentors and also to invite schools to participate. So I have been busy contacting deans and presidents and other kinds of academic administrators to offer them the opportunity to be a lead institution, which means they will get to provide support mentors as well as enroll their students. And the sort of standard response is, wow, this is a great idea. It's so exciting. Thank you for asking, which is just really nice.
You know, that's so interesting and I would say so important. Can you again spell out those two initiatives?
So it's called WITSON, WITS, capital O-N, and it's not formally announced yet, so it'll probably be formally announced in about a month. And Piazza is the name of the other, P-I-A-Z-Z-A, is the name of the startup that we're working with. And, you know, this is an example of, so the way I got connected with Piazza was Ari Levy, who's the Bloomberg Businessweek reporter who published the first article about what MUD has been doing about women in CS in Bloomberg Business Week last September. I was visiting Ari at the Bloomberg offices in San Francisco, and he said, have you heard about Piazza? Have you met Pooja? And I said, no. And he said, oh, they're doing this, they have this interesting initiative that they want to do, and I'll introduce you. So he did, and then Pooja and I did a phone call, and Pooja just had her first child, a son, like a month ago, perhaps, and you know, they're, as I said, a 12-person company. So Phil Soffer, who was in charge of organizing this, was just pulling his hair out because he's going like, we don't have enough bandwidth to do this. And I said, oh, well, that's okay because MUD will do it with you. We'll do it jointly, and we'll do the part that are easy for us, and you'll do the parts that are easy for you. And it has been so much fun working with them. I mean, it's just, they're just fabulous people. They're, so it's sort of like, I'm really enjoying the opportunity not to do my own startup, but to be helping out other startups. And I also have a good relationship with a nonprofit startup called Reasoning Mind that I probably mentioned before that's doing a web-based approach to math education. And I love working with them as well. So it's, you know, it's fun to be in a place where you can actually help people do things.
You know, the math startup, is that something that's going to be sort of Creative Commons open source sort of thing or publicly available? Or?
If you want to use Reasoning Mind, I mean, one of the things, I mean, initially they thought they could just make it available and it would work, but the thing that lots of research has shown, including research that you know, my eGEMS team did back in the 90s, is that if you really want students to learn, you have to have a human being engaged in making feel that what they're learning, whether they're learning it online or not, is important. And so to use Reasoning Mind, essentially a school has to sign up. So the teacher who's going to be teaching Reasoning Mind has to do about 150 hours of training in their first year. And so schools, so I think you might be thinking about doing a homeschooling initiative at some point, but right now, if you want to use it, you really need to be a school that signs up to use it, and you need to, you know, it costs real money. Currently, schools had a lot of funding from various foundations, including the Gates Foundation, Houston Endowment, ExxonMobil Foundation, et cetera. And so currently about half the cost of what it actually costs to run the system is paid for from foundations, and the other half is paid by the participating school. And it's a really, really great approach, because what really happens is right now Reasoning Mind covers 2nd through 6th grade, and what happens is many elementary school teachers are actually math phobic, and you know, they really don't deeply understand the concepts that they're teaching. And, you know, even though we may think like things like fractions and decimals and so on are pretty easy to understand, in fact, most children who, in the United States at least, really don't understand what they're learning. And what happens is that when the teacher gets this training, the teacher eventually starts to fundamentally understand the concepts, and of course becomes a better teacher at the same time. So it's a really wonderful approach.
On Piazza, is there a challenge with fundraising at all, or are they sort of well on their way?
They're still challenged in terms of fundraising. I mean, they have about 40,000 students using enrolled in schools that are using their software right now. They think they can probably break even without, you know, foundation money, but when they scale up to, you know, maybe 100,000 or 150,000 students, and they're definitely in that stage. I mean, this is started by a couple and their son, and you know, they're definitely in that stage where they're working hard to, you know, hire professional, you know, VP sales, et cetera, and you know, move from being a mom and pop shop kind of thing to being, you know, a larger organization that can scale up the enrollment in their classes. So I'm very optimistic that they're going to make it, but they're still at a stage where it's a genuine challenge.
Maria, with all of the contributions you made and all the interactions you have with people worldwide, and you know, you've been a leader in innovation, what are the lessons that you want to pass on with regards to innovation?
Yeah. So the first thing I'll say is, you know, pick an important problem, because I mean, you might as well work on the things that really matter in life. If you're going to put a lot of energy into something, you might as well pick something that really matters. And the second thing is, it's been my experience that having a diverse team is really important. And, I mean, this sort of comes out of the example I described at Jane Street Capital that, you know, the thing I love about my team of vice presidents and Karen and Kelly is that they have very different perspectives and personalities. And because they're so different, you know, some of them are very detail-oriented, some of them are philosophical, some of them are outspoken, some of them are quiet. And what you find is when you have really diverse people working on a problem, you get much, much better solutions. And because you can see different sides of the issues. And so diverse teams would be my second thing. The third one is the importance of persistence and hard work. You know, especially when things are not going well, you know, sometimes, I mean, no matter what problem you take on, if it's challenging, there will be times when you really think you're not going to succeed. And, that's when you have to work the hardest and persist. And, I look over and over again. I look at situations. I look at people going through difficult situations. And, I know that the ability to just stay at it and keep on driving is very important. And then the flip side of that, however, is, sometimes the thing you're persistent, you may actually have the wrong approach. And so it's also, in addition to persisting and working hard, it's really important to regularly sort of like take a step back and reevaluate the plan and strategy you have and be willing to change when necessary. Because, it's sometimes you're just, so far into the weeds that you just really can't see the fact that the thing you're pushing so hard on is either not the most important thing or there's a much better strategy that walks around it or whatever. And then the last one, which is I think the most recent one I have really learned, is to ask for help. And the thing I've just realized is that, sometimes there really are, there are people who, with not a ton of effort on their part, can really help you. And so, this is, Piazza really needed help. And, fortunately, Ari put us in touch and they asked me for help. And it's been my vacation project. While I've been on Pinder, I've been working on this and it's been just interesting and fun and very rewarding and not a ton of work. And so, just this idea that there really are people who can make a difference. So, I think I've probably mentioned before one of my big challenges at MUD is our difficulty in recruiting African American students because we're just not well enough known in the Black community. And so I put together a list of advisors who I've asked for help with this. And one of them, Roger Ferguson, who's the CEO of TIAA CREF, I was meeting with him and he came up with, a list of suggestions, all of which we had tried. And then he finally said, Maria, ask Freeman Hrabowski to help you. Because he has become, really just in the last year or two, the outspoken spokesperson in the African-American community for the need for more African-Americans to go into careers in science and engineering. And people really listened to Freeman. And, Freeman was already one of my, he's a good friend. He's, was already on my list of advisors, but it never occurred to me to ask him just so specifically that question. Like, Freeman, will you please talk about Harvey Mudd College when you're talking? Freeman's the president of the University of Maryland at Baltimore County. And will you please talk about us as well? And he said, well, I'm already talking about it, but now I'll really talk about it. And, it was such a good suggestion. And, so I've really embraced this idea of being explicitly willing to ask for help. And of course, my big success in the last year was asking Sheryl Sandberg for help, and she's been extraordinary in terms of, increasing our visibility around the issue of women and technology. And so now I've got Freeman working for us on this issue of African Americans coming to Harvard Mudd College. So those would be my five lessons. Pick an important problem, build a diverse team, persist and work hard, regularly reevaluate your plan and strategy and change when you have to, and then ask for help when you need it.
Maria, you've had many years of significant contributions in the nonprofit space. So can you describe your involvement with the Association of Computing Machinery and your various roles?
Yeah, so I think I was asked to be a candidate for the council sometime in the 90s. Of ACM. And I said yes, and I got elected. And then it must have been the late 90s because they were having a conversation at a council meeting about planning for the next sort of big ACM conference, which was going to be held in 2001 in San Jose. And it was going to be called ACM1. And they had a list of suggested invited speakers, and the list probably had, 25, 30 names on it. And you can guess how many of those names are female. None. And so I made a stink about it. And at the council meeting, and just, really was pushing for, how could you possibly have a list of names and not bother to think of any women? Of course, all the organizers were male. And, as a result of that, I got asked to run for the position of vice president, within, probably, I don't know, a month after that meeting. And I agreed to do it, and I was elected. And then after, and when I, they had originally asked me if I'd run for the position of president. I said, absolutely not. I don't have time. And so then they said, well, how about vice president? I said, fine. And they sort of said, you know, the vice president doesn't really have any role. And, you know, there's no expectation that you necessarily have to run for president after being vice president. So it's sort of like, you know, a very easy thing to say yes to. So, of course, after 2 years as vice president, I was asked to run as president. And by then, I was sort of like, you know, when I was asked to run for vice president, I was fairly early in, I think I might have been at the end of my first year as dean of science at UBC, and, you know, always the first year in the job is very, is tough. And so, but by the time they asked me to run for president, you know, I'd done 3 years as dean of science, I was, everything was going fine, I was happy, and I said, sure, and I was elected. And then, you know, it turned out that, you know, shortly thereafter, I learned I was going to move to president and to Princeton as dean of engineering, and so I ended up being president during during the time of the move and during my first year at as dean of engineering at Princeton, which was again tough. And I remember somebody asked me towards the end of my term as ACM president what I would try to accomplish if I had another year as president. And I said, I would just kill myself. I couldn't do another year as president. But I really love the ACM. It's a great organization. Obviously it is a huge sponsor and disseminator of research in terms of what it does with conferences and with journals. It has had, you know, great people as presidents, great people on the council, great staff. I mean, just, you know, really proud of it as an organization to work with. One of the things that happened during my time there was we started the Computer Science Teachers Association, and which has, I think, is having a significant role in terms of supporting computer science education in at the high school level and even pre-high school level. After I had finished being president, I was asked to serve on the Turing Award Selection Committee. And at the time that I went on the committee, there had been no female winners of the Turing Award in whatever 40 years or like that. And so one of the things I said at the first meeting of the selection committee was that, you know, when you're on the Turing Award selection committee, you typically serve 5 years. And I said, in my 5 years, there are going to be two female computer scientists who win the Turing Award. And the then chair of the committee said, you can't possibly bring in an agenda like that. We're not supposed to think about gender, you know, when we're making choices like this. And I just went, look, if you really think there aren't two women computer scientists who deserve it, you're just not thinking hard enough about who the possible candidates are. And sure enough, two women did win. Fran Allen was the first one, and Barbara Liskov was the second one. And the thing that was interesting to me was that Fran Allen had a very strong case and had been, you know, one of the sort of runner-ups for about 10 years in a row. And, you know, it just kept on just not quite happening. Somebody else was always deemed to be a more important choice than Fran. When we finally gave it to Fran, MIT then the next year nominated Barbara Liskov. And, you know, Barbara had never been nominated before. And I think that until Fran won, you know, MIT, the department just wasn't thinking about the fact that they had this amazing candidate that they could nominate. And, I feel very good that we finally broke that barrier. And, I'm sure there will be more women that will win it in the next decade as well. And it just has become something that people actually think about. And I think that is it for ACM.
So what's your history with the Anita Borg Institute for Women and Technology, and why is this work important?
Well, that's another great one, another fabulous group of people. Anita Borg was one of my very close friends. I first met her, I think, in 1984, but didn't really get to know her well until the early 90s. And, it was one of these things where I had invited her to come up and give a talk at UBC. And I had also invited her, because I'd found out that she'd like to kayak, to come and visit me on Pender Island. And just the way the timing worked out, she came to Pender for a couple of days before we both went back to Vancouver, and then she gave her talk at UBC. And our cottage is a very small place. It's 806 square feet. And I suddenly realized as she was arriving that here, you know, it's going to be the two of us alone in this cottage, and I really didn't know this person well. And, you know, I picked her up from the ferry in the evening, and we had a glass of wine, we went to bed, I got up the next morning, and I have no idea what question I asked Anita, but within 30 seconds, she was telling me about how the first time she ever had sex with a boy was when, just before she turned 18, was in the back seat of a Ford, and she got pregnant from it, and had to go to Japan for an abortion. And I was just like, sort of, what? And we ended up talking absolutely nonstop for 14 hours. We went kayaking for 12 hours of that time. I mean, it was just like I had found, like, my soulmate in some really important way, because she was just one of the most open, interesting, funny, super smart, and not afraid to be crazy. And of course, we shared this passion for getting more women into computing careers and also thinking about how to use technology to really improve the lives of women around the world. And so we just became very, very good friends. And, you know, maybe a year after that, she started talking to me about this conference that she wanted to organize called that she was going to name the Grace Hopper Celebration of Women in Computing. And she was going to have it in D.C., and it was going to be a celebration of the fact that there had been a whole bunch of wonderful female computer scientists who've done great things. And I eventually got asked to be one of the keynote speakers for that. I think there was about a dozen. And the event had, I think, 450 attendees, of which three were male. And I remember standing in the lobby of the hotel and looking around and seeing all these female computer scientists. And even if I didn't know them, I knew they were female computer scientists because they dressed like female computer scientists. And it was just the most wonderful feeling. And then being in this room with, you know, 447 female computer scientists. I mean, we were just all going like, oh my God, look at this. It happened. A couple of years after that, so the plan was Hopper would be once every 3 years. And a couple of years after that, she started talking to me about how, at the time she was working for the DEC World Western Research Lab, DEC World, and she was, you know, she worked on operating systems kinds of stuff. And she said, you know, I'm thinking about stopping doing this kind of research and starting an organization that will just focus on recruiting and retaining women in tech careers, as well as thinking about how to use technology to improve the lives of women around the world. And I'm sort of going, really? You're really going to do that? And I said, is that going to support that? And she said, well, actually, I've been talking to the folks at Xerox PARC, and it sounds like they're interested. And you know, we talked about it some more, and then, you know, a little while later, she said, okay, I'm really going to do it. It's going to be a nonprofit, and I need to have a board of trustees. Will you be one of the trustees? And I was either the first or the second person she asked. The other person she asked at the same time was Bill Wolf, who I believe this was before he became president of the National Academy of Engineering. But in any case, both Bill and I said yes, and then, you know, gradually the board grew. And Hopper eventually moved to being every other year instead of every third year. And I remember I was on we started running this senior summit program for women the day before Hopper. And I was on the organizing committee for that day-long event that was going to be held in Cape Cod. And going to be held in Cape Cod in 2000. So this must have been either early 2000 or late 1999. And Anita wasn't on the phone call. Kelly Whitney, who's now and has been for the last 10 years or so the CEO of the Ingeborg Institute, Kelly told me, and it was interesting because Kelly was probably Anita's closest friend from industry, and I was Anita's closest friend from academia. But Telly and I mean, we had met maybe once or twice, but we really didn't know each other. And neither of us really realized at the time what a close friend the other person was with Anita. And Kelly happened to mention that earlier that week, Anita had been diagnosed with brain cancer with glioblastoma, which is virtually always fatal. And I remember I was in somebody else's office who was also on the organizing committee for this AnCondon, and I just burst into tears. And it's just like, it was just so unacceptable that Anita at the time was 51, that somebody with so much passion for life and having so much impact on the world around her could possibly be had brain cancer. So they typically, the stage of the cancer she was at, she would have typically had about 12 months. And, you know, we were very lucky that she actually lived for 3 more years. And one of the things I remember talking to Anita, who'd already, by the time the Cape Cod Hopper Conference happened, she'd already had surgery and radiation. And I remember saying to Anita, you know, if you're going to, you know, have the bad grace to die young, I'm going to take crass advantage of making you famous. And so one of the things I worked on for the next year was a collage of paintings of Anita and doing different kinds of things called Anita's Ribbon, and did paintings of Anita all the time from her childhood through her marriage to Winfred Wilkie that happened, shortly after she was diagnosed. And I also, in that particular painting, I have a number of other women. There's an image of Grace Hopper as a young woman, an image of Grace Hopper as an admiral in the Navy. There's an image of Fran Allen. There's an image of me and Denise Stanton and Anita together. And there's an image of Barbara Simons and, you know, various other folks. And so as Anita became more disabled, it became clear that somebody was going to have to step in and take over and run the institute. And, you know, Kelly, who had just sold her startup, volunteered that she would do it for a few months. And we did a search to replace, you know, for the permanent person. And, you know, the search committee felt that none of the candidates were really suitable. And so we managed to persuade Kelly that she should stay on as the permanent CEO. And this was all happening in around the time of the next Hopper, which was 2002, which was in Vancouver. And I remember riding on an escalator with Kelly at the conference, and Kelly said, well, I'll stay on as permanent CEO if you will be chair of the board. And, you know, of course, this was also just as I was starting about to, I knew at that point that I was going to be going to Princeton starting January 1st of 2003, and this would be, you know, sort of October 2002. And, of course, I said yes because, you know, it was clear to me that Kelly was the right person to take on this role. And so I spent 5 years as chair of the board, and I was on the board for a total of 14 years. I went off a little bit more than a year ago, partly because I'm a big believer that people should rotate off boards, partly because Anita Borg Institute is doing incredibly well. And, you know, I try to put time into things where I think I can actually make a difference. And as much as I love everything that ABI does, I felt like they didn't absolutely need me. And, they have become the world's organization that focuses on the need to have more diverse teams, including gender diverse, on, you know, the fact that there are just incredible career opportunities for everyone in IT. And also, you know, that there's an intense need for more people that that understand computer science and have technical knowledge, and that it's really important that a lot of those be women. And so I feel, I still grieve for the loss of Anita. I mean, some part of my brain, I sort of believe she lives on. When she was, after she died at the memorial service, Kelly and I became very close friends after Anita's death, and we sort of looked at each other and said, okay, well, the way we're going to have Anita live on is we're each going to start doing things that Anita loved to do, and, you know, together we will make up Anita. And so Anita loved to dress up, and so Kelly got into dressing up. I still am not into dressing up. And I decided I was going to learn how to do river kayaking because that's what Anita loved. And I never got any good at river kayaking, but, you know, it was sort of our way of saying, we will replace who Anita was in our lives by being the other person to each other. And that has stayed true in many respects.
Oh, I should say, in your involvement with the Anita Borg Institute, you also talked about being involved with the Grace Hopper Conference and keynoting and, you know, bringing teams there and perhaps in earlier interviews and so on. Can you describe other parts of your involvement with that conference and why does this matter?
Well, I attended every Hopper Conference. It's now run annually, and I've attended every single one except for one. The one that I missed was in 2010, and it was because it was at exactly the same time as the Harvey Mudd College Board meeting. And obviously, I have to be at every Harvey Mudd College Board meeting. It's so many different things. So one of the things that happens is that there is a dance, usually on the Friday night. And there's a dance one night. It's usually after the banquet. And it's one of those, since the vast number of attendees are female, we're now up to about 3,000 attendees, of which maybe 100 are men. Obviously, everyone's just dancing without dancing partners. And it's just such an amazing expression of joy. And of course, there's a dance because Anita loved to dance. And, but it's probably the only occasion in my life these days when I actually dance with young people, because about half of the attendees at Hopper are typically students, a mix of undergraduate and graduate students. And just seeing all these young women so full of life and excitement and joy is just an amazing thing. It's also become a major place where tech companies recruit for interns and for and regular positions. And one of the things that happens, and you know, I mentioned swag beforehand. You've never seen as much swag as there is at Hopper, and it's female-centered swag. So it's like the students are just like they've never seen anything like this, and they come home with, you know, bags full of stuff from different companies. And there's a complete mix of kinds of talks. There are research talks. There's a poster session for students to present their research. There are career professional development talks. There are mentoring talks. There are, it's just, you know, if you want to go and just hear about research, you could spend your whole time doing that. If you want to go and just learn about career opportunities, you could spend the entire conference doing that. And the next Hopper is in Baltimore. In early October, and Freeman Hrabowski, who I mentioned a little while ago, and I are both on a panel about mentoring. And, you know, it's just a very special part of the computer science community experience now, and I don't know of anything quite like it in any other discipline. I mean, I think of it as just personifying Anita's approach to life, which was, you know, work on hard things, make a difference, make sure you have fun while you're doing it. And so it's just truly inspirational as well as a lot of fun.
Can you share some of the keynotes that have occurred there?
One of my favorite things that happened at Hopper was one of my former graduate students, Corey Inkpen, who's now a senior researcher at Microsoft and leads a research group. She works in human-computer interaction. And Corey, I'm trying to remember where this first happened. I think it was the Hopper Telluride. Corey emailed me and said, let's submit a panel proposal called the Imposter Panel. And what we'll do is we'll get five women that everyone would see as being highly successful, and they'll each talk about what makes them feel like an imposter in their life. And so we did, and we got, you know, women from academia and industry, and we each made a set of four PowerPoint slides. The first one says, my career as a such-and-such imposter. So mine was, my career as a presidential imposter. The next slide is, you know, the positions that you've held, a timeline of positions you've held during your career, because the point that we're making is that, okay, it looks like, you know, each of us has actually been successful. And then the third slide starts out with, I feel like an imposter when I. And for me, I did it, you know, what made me feel like an imposter in the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, 2000s. And then the final slide is, I cope with imposteritis by, and then you fill in what you do. And, it was, you know, it was scheduled in a room that probably could hold 200 people. And not only was every seat taken, every piece of the floor was covered. And then there was a queue of people standing outside the door trying to stick their heads in and listen to it. And it was just hilarious. And so, you know, that idea has been repeated at many different, not just at Hopper conferences, but departments have hosted imposter panels with their alumni. And it's just become sort of like something that people do. And I have one of my students from MUD, Lillian DeGrief, who's going to do her PhD at the University of Washington. She just graduated this year. And as she came to say goodbye, she gave me a huge hug, and she said, "Maria, I just want to tell you that probably because of the fact you talk about it so much, I've never once felt like an imposter." I went like, "Yeah, that's great. I totally love that."
Well, I guess that brings up the question then, where have you felt like an imposter, and how did you manage it?
Okay, well, so in the 70s, I felt like an imposter whenever I had to eat in public or take a taxi, or, you know, because growing up, my family didn't have a lot of money when I was a kid, and we didn't eat out in restaurants often, and we didn't take taxis often. And, you know, like, to me, the whole concept of getting in a car and, you know, like, with a stranger was just like, holy cow, this is really dangerous. And, you know, so I remember I attended my first conference, would have been in maybe 1975, and I was completely freaked out. It was the annual meetings of the American Mass Society, and, you know, I was going to sessions, and everyone else seemed to know each other, and I didn't know a single person, and, you know, I just felt like there must be a big sign on my head that said, I don't belong here, because nobody spoke to me. And after spending the first day like that and just feeling totally horrible, the next day, I made a point of actually going up and introducing myself to people, because I realized, you know, like, they're not going to change it, so I better change it. And by the time I was, you know, it was the 80s, it was, you know, I remember the first talk I gave at Stanford University, and it was in Don Knuth's Algorithms for Lentigut, 1980. We had just started working at IBM Research in San Jose, and I had been invited to give a talk, and I had decided I was going to talk about a result that I had gotten with my husband Nick and somebody who'd been a grad student with me at the University of Toronto, Jim Hoover, who's now a faculty member at the University of Alberta. And as I was preparing my talk, I became convinced that this was the stupidest result ever, that it was totally trivial, that everybody, when they listened to the talk, would just look at me and say, "You think people at Stanford would be interested in talk about such a stupid result?" And, you know, Nick was trying to calm me down, and I was just like, I was having none of it. And of course, I went and I gave the talk, and it was a huge success, and people loved it because it was understandable, and Knuth loved it, and, you know, and, you know, it just sort of goes on. Like, by the time it was the 90s, it was like the first time I ever gave a press conference. I was just terrified. I thought I was going to be just a huge failure. The first time, you know, I started to meet CEOs was really, of major companies in the U.S., was really when I was at Princeton. And, you know, again, I was just like, oh, my God, you know, like, what am I doing? And I will tell you that, you know, the first day that I arrived at Microsoft for the first board meeting, I was just like beside myself with terror. So, you know, what I've realized over time is that whenever I start something new, even if it's something I really wanted to do, and I really wanted to do the Microsoft board, I was just, you know, I just think I'm going to be a total failure at it. And then, you know, of course, the most important thing is to not stop yourself from doing things just because you think you're going to be a total failure. The important thing is to just do it. And, you know, so when I'm feeling like this, I just remind myself of all the other times in the past when I have felt this way about something that later became something that was completely easy and comfortable to do. And, you know, just remind myself that this is something that happens to me. It's an affliction, but it's not deadly. And, you know, it probably makes me more humble and more helpful to other people because I have this affliction. So.
Now, you did talk about, you know, sort of the work you've done with regards to mathematics and your contributions there, but also mathematical societies and mathematical research. Can you share your experiences and lessons with the Mathematical Sciences Research Institute in Berkeley?
Yeah, So, I can't remember. Have I talked about Jennifer Chase?
No, not that I can recall.
Okay. So Jennifer is a very close friend of mine. In fact, in many ways, I would say she is the person who replaced, I mean, in addition to Tally, replaced the role that Anita played in my life. And, we became close friends in 2001. We knew, she's also a mathematician by background. She built the theoretical computer science group at Microsoft Research in Redmond. And then, I think it's maybe 3 years or 4 years ago, she moved to Boston to, together with her husband, Christian Borg, to create the New England Research Lab for Microsoft. And I suspect it was Jennifer who suggested me. Jennifer has been on the board of the Mathematical Sciences Research Institute in Berkeley for, I would guess, at least 10 years. And I suspect she was the person who suggested me as a trustee. So MSRI is, it is sort of the premier place. There are several mathematical research institutes. There's one called Institute for Mathematics and its Applications that's in Minneapolis, St. Paul at the University of Minnesota. There's the Fields Institute at the University of Toronto. There's IPAMD, Institute for Pure and Applied Mathematics at UCLA. But MSRI is, I would say, sort of the premier one of all of the mathematical institutes, and the model it has really sort of established the idea of this kind of institute. It runs one or two themes a year, and brings in, you know, a number of senior people as well as a number of postdocs running workshops around those themes. And it's in this gorgeous location up above Berkeley, so it looks out over across the bay to San Francisco. And I had become involved with MSRI shortly after it started, partly because I helped arrange for a donation of computers from IBM while I was at IBM Amadin, and also because Nick and I participated in one of the theme years going up to Berkeley twice a week for the entire year with a theme on theoretical computer science. And so I'd always loved the place. So when I was asked to be a trustee, now, of all the things that I do with my life, MSRI has got to be one of the easiest responsibilities because the official responsibility is simply to attend one meeting a year, which is always the first Saturday in March. But more recently, I've got involved with both recruiting people to be trustees. I'm on the nominating committee, and I'm also on the fundraising committee, the development committee, and right now we're fundraising to match a challenge from Jim Simon. And I get, you know, it's one of those examples where I love the people on the board. I love what the Institute does. It's just really fun being part of that community. And it's an opportunity to sort of have my foot in the mathematical research community, which I also really enjoy. Now, just recently, I agreed to be co-chair of the scientific advisory committee for the new Simons Institute at Berkeley for theoretical computer science. And this has just been, I mean, it's literally just starting. And so that's, I mean, I happen to totally love Berkeley as an institution. I mean, it's just one of my favorite public research universities. And so, you know, with both MSRI and with the Simons Center, I get to have this opportunity to be part of a larger research community that I don't necessarily have being president at MUD.
So along the same theme then, what lessons can you share from your leadership position with the American Mathematical Society?
The person who got me into doing that was a very well-known mathematician called Ron Graham, and I've been friends with Ron and his wife, Fan. I think I met Ron when I was 24 years old, so it was a long time. And Ron was somebody, you know, so I met him before I finished my PhD. I met him the year before, or maybe the year I was finishing my PhD. And, you know, Ron paid attention, and one of the things Ron does is he tries to identify young mathematicians who have potential, leadership potential. And, you know, I remember, you know, I met him at a conference. I spent the last year of my PhD at UBC, essentially doing a postdoc, even though I was still officially still writing out my thesis. And I met him at this conference, and then, you know, I gave a talk at the winter mass meetings, maybe 6 months later, and I remember Ron came to my talk, which was, you know, was in an area of functional analysis, which isn't even particularly an area that Ron likes, but he obviously had decided to keep an eye on me. And so in, I think it was 1990, Ron asked me if I was willing to run for, take on a position as a trustee of the American Math Society. Now, there are two different groups that basically oversee the AMS. One of them is the council, and it basically handles sort of policy issues. And the other is the board of trustees, who are basically responsible for all of the financial issues. And you know, I was honored to be asked. It's a very responsible position for the American Math Society, but I really didn't think I had time in my life to do it at that point. And it was interesting because Ron said, you know, if it's something you really want to do, you should look at the things in your life that you don't really need to do right now and juggle them so that you have space to do it. The thing I learned from being a trustee for 5 years was it was a ton of work, but it really gave me an education about how professional societies operate. And, you know, that I hadn't been in that kind of sort of financial situation working with, you know, budgets for, you know, a major organization before. And so I think, you know, I learned a great deal about, you know, financial matters from those 5 years. I also just learned a lot about how a professional society operates. And, you know, I think that was a very good background to bring into, you know, the roles, in, you know, being president of ACM, for example, because, you know, it was a board that was very heavily involved in the detailed budget decisions. And so, yeah, great training, great learning experience.
And then what lessons can you share from your leadership position with the Computing Research Association?
So the Computing Research Association, Ed Lazowska, who's another long-term friend and a leading computer scientist at the University of Washington, Ed had contacted me, I think, in 89, saying, are you willing to stand for election to the board of the Computing Research Association? And he said, and you probably won't be elected, so, you know, I'm not really asking you for much other than just to let your name run. I said, sure, and I wasn't elected. So when he asked a year later, I didn't even think twice about it. He said, of course, I'm happy to run and not be elected. That's really cool. And I got elected. And so it turned out that I was the first female ever elected to the board. It had been around for 20 years and had never had a female member on it. And you know, I, of course, made an issue of this. And 2 years later, 30% of the members were female. And, you know, I mean, so often people are just not thinking about it. It's just not anywhere on their horizon. They don't think it's unusual for there not to be any women in the room, and then you get a woman in the room, and the woman in the room says, how come there aren't any other women in the room? They go, oh, yeah, there are lots of women who we could put up for election. So, but the other thing that probably is more important is that together with Nancy Levison, who was at that point, I think, at UCI, then moved to University of Washington and then to MIT, I think the vice chair of the board at that point was Peter Freeman. And Peter Freeman introduced me to Nancy. They've been friends for a long time. They both worked in software engineering. And Nancy and I decided that we would propose to the CRA board that we start a committee on the status of women in computing that would really try to look at what the issues were that affected the low participation of women in computing research careers. And the board agreed, and so the next year, so this is 1991, we had the first meeting of CRAW, and we had a number of rules that we put in place for how this committee was going to function. The first one was that we would have co-chairs of the committee, so that because, you know, women in computing careers are extremely busy because everyone's asking them to do everything. And so we figured if we did co-chairs, it would be a lot more manageable. The second thing was the idea is that nobody could be on the committee unless they were going to actually undertake some responsibility for a project that would actually make a difference. Like, you couldn't just be on the committee because, you know, it would look good on your resume. You
So it's going to be an action-packed committee. And the third one was that it was going to be, wanted to demonstrate that people who were, that women who were, and men who were successful researchers cared about the issue. Because quite often in various organizations, the sort of the stuff about women doesn't get done by the whole high-profile women. It's done by sort of the people who are doing it as, you know, because they're not busy doing something else. And so we wanted to make this the opposite of that. And so, you know, most of the most distinguished women researchers in North America have, say, served on CRAW at some point. And if you look at the list of people who serve as co-chairs, it's really quite extraordinary. And, you know, one of the things that's been true, wasn't true when CRAW was formed, but has been true for probably at least the last, CRAW I think is maybe, well, I guess I know since it started in 1991, it's 21 years old, so it just turned an adult this year. I'd say for at least the last dozen, maybe 15 years, the percentage of women going to graduate school has been as high or higher than the percentage of women as undergraduate majors. This is certainly true since 2000, and because the percentage of women in graduate students has stayed slightly above 20% for quite a while, whereas, as you know, the percentage of women majoring, being undergraduate majors at research universities has been between, you know, 11 and 14% for the, at least the last 10 years. And so it's quite dramatic that, that you can have the number of women, in graduate programs being twice the percentage or almost twice the percentage of the number of women in undergraduate programs. And it's also the case that if you look at, the hiring records for universities and computer science departments, they have hired at or slightly above the percentage of women getting PhDs, so it's been around 20-22% of the people who've been hired into, you know, assistant professor positions have been slightly better than the number of women, the percentage of PhDs that are going to women. And I credit a lot of this to the programs conducted by CRAW. They have, you know, so one of the things that we know about getting women to go to grad school is if you can get them engaged in research as undergraduates, they're more likely to go to graduate school. So they have run a program focusing on doing that probably since 92 or 93. They have programs about, they offer workshops at major computer science conferences that give you advice on, you know, how to get started in an academic career, how to interview for jobs, how to get your teaching started, how to get your research started, how to write research grants, how to balance family or personal and career challenges. Just all of this kind of stuff. And, you know, initially they're for women only, but now actually CRAW does it for men as well because it's clear that men need the same advice, and they've been just very popular, very well attended. They run, with funding from, I think, Google and Microsoft, they run a program called the Grad Cohort, where they take usually about 250 women starting their PhDs in a first year of PhD program in computer science, and they bring them together, I think it's two or three times during the time of their PhD program for mentoring. So that what they're trying to do is create, you know, a cohort that will be going through this experience, because, you know, often there may be only a few, maybe two women starting the PhD program at the same time as you at your university, or five, or but a relatively small group. And it's great to know a couple of hundred people who are in a similar situation to the situation that you're in. So it's just been a very active, very successful group, and, you know, has it won one of the presidential, U.S. presidential mentoring awards a couple of years ago. It's gotten lots of recognition. And, you know, one of the things I feel great about it is I was co-chair for 3 years, helped get it started, and then it has run on its own since then.
That's a remarkable record. You also are a contributor to the nonprofit Math for America. Can you describe what your role is and then what you hope to achieve?
So the whole idea for Math for America, it was founded by Jim Simons, who's a very distinguished mathematician, as well as a very successful hedge fund founder, founded Renaissance Technologies in the 70s. And Jim, you know, feels really strongly that math education in high school and in middle school is extraordinarily important, and that that one of the reasons, I mean, and I'll just say, you know, mathematics education, say, in British Columbia and Alberta is so much stronger than it is in California. I mean, it's just like, the situation is really pretty bad. And so Jim's idea was, you know, the real problem is that, you know, it used to be that, you know, there were really only three jobs that women could get. You could be a nurse, you could be a teacher, and you could be a secretary. And, you know, and so a lot of the great math teachers were women who were, you know, it was one of the options that you had if you were good at math. And, of course, now that, you know, salaries for people with mathematical ability, whether on Wall Street or in the tech industry, are so much higher, it's often the case that the person who's teaching math at junior high or high school level actually, you know, did not major in mathematics, has not had a lot of university level mathematics. Because people who have the ability to be a great teacher and also really know mathematics well have many other more respected and highly paid job opportunities. So his idea was, let's recruit people who are either great math teachers and already in the system, or who would like to be a math teacher and you know, have very good understanding of mathematics and have the potential to be a great math teacher. For those, let's give them get them a master's degree in education, get them qualified to teach schools, and then let's provide both professional development for starting teachers and for distinguished outstanding teachers, as well as an extra stipend, and as well as recognition, so that we're giving, so we're making this a competitive job opportunity to other options. And so he started this must be about 8 years ago now in New York City, and a couple of years after I went to MUD, one of his board members, who was then the director of the Mathematical Sciences Research Institute at Berkeley, which we talked about earlier, David Eisenbud, who is a long-term friend of Jim Simons and on the Math for America board, said, Maria, I'd like to nominate you to the board. Would you be willing to stand for election? Now, what do presidents do? They look for wealthy people who care about the kind of thing their institution does. So I'm always looking for, you know, billionaires who care about science and engineering education. And so I said, sure. And Math for America board meets twice a year in New York City. And after the next meeting, David called, and he was very apologetic, and he said, I'm sorry, but you weren't elected. And in fact, what had happened was they had put forward six names to be elected, but they hadn't really bothered to do their homework. And so they only had resumes for one of the six people, and that he was the only person that got elected. And they decided for the others that they needed to get more information on them, which is all perfectly reasonable, but it annoyed me. So I knew from talking to David that the thing that Jim most wanted to happen next for Math for America is he was trying to get a national program funded by the federal government, and he needed to show that you could make it happen at another major city. And I thought, I will start Math for America in Los Angeles, seeing they want one. I mean, it's the obvious, you know, other major city to New York, and LAUSD has terrible problems. So, you know, it made sense to try and do it there. So I knew that we couldn't do it by MUD alone. First of all, we don't even have an education school, and secondly, we're just too small. So I contacted the guy, Max Nikias, who was provost at USC at that point, and also the dean of education at the Claremont Graduate University, and asked if they would co-found Math for America in Los Angeles with me, and they said absolutely. So then we invited the executive director of Math for America, a mathematician, at that point a mathematician called Irwin Craw, and had him come out. And he was just amazed that, you know, we decided to start it. He came to a meeting in November, and by February we were accepting applications for a first cohort of people that we would send, you know, put in graduate school and had already, you know, close to finalized our first grant, which was for $1.8 million from the Rose Hills Foundation. And, you know, Math for America had never seen a program get started so quickly. And so at the next board meeting, of course they elected me to the board. And at this point, Math for America programs have been started, I think, in 7 cities, but Los Angeles is by far the most successful. And, of course, it did, you know, it did help me, you know, do some fundraising, with Jim Simons for Harvard Mind College, so it all worked out.
Well, that clearly demonstrates that you always take action.
Yeah, no, I love Math for America. It's the person that works on it with me at Harvey Mudd College is one of our math faculty members, Daryl Young, whom I totally adore. He's also our associate dean for diversity on the faculty side. And Daryl, who is just passionate about math education, has worked on many different programs. He says Math for America is just the best program he's ever seen. And I feel that way, too. It is just because it's all about the teachers. I mean, it's all about, instead of complaining about teachers, it's all about giving teachers the kind of resources and support that they need to actually be successful. So, yeah, it's been a lot of fun, and I love Jim Simons. I've managed to recruit 2 members of the Math for America board, the Harvey Mudd College board, Pete Muller and Neil Chris, and I'm working on 2 more. So, yeah, it's turned out to be just a great opportunity for Harvey Mudd College.
Maria, when we look at your history, you've won so many awards and you've been recognized by so many different groups. Can you talk about some of those awards and your experiences with them?
One of the things about getting awards is that people already have awards get given more of them. I mean, it's just a very strange phenomenon. So I sort of went through, there was a period of time, about 5 years, my last 5 years at UBC, where when I received a lot of Canadian awards, and those ones were particularly, I think probably the ones that, because it came at an earlier stage of my life, it was incredibly meaningful, and you know, it was just an opportunity to have, you know, usually when you win an award, it's not really for something you did, it's for something you were part of a team of that did, and I felt it was just wonderful recognition for many of the things that we had been doing around women in computer science and women in science and engineering at UBC. And, you know, I'm sure I've said this many, many times, but the University of British Columbia is just like one of, you know, like Berkeley and even more so, it is just one of my favorite institutions in the world, and it has been incredibly creative and innovative in the kinds of things it's done. So, you know, the set of awards, you know, that happened in the late 90s and early 2000 were just incredibly meaningful because it was like a recognition for, you know, a more than a decade of work that many, many people were engaged in. And then I think it was 2001 that I received my first honorary doctorate. And it was from Ryerson University, and I had no interaction with Ryerson at all, so I was quite surprised. And when they were doing, they have a tradition, they do sort of a roast at a banquet either before or after the ceremony, and so they had people like the Cornels from the University of Toronto. They had a number of people from earlier in my career telling stories about me. And at that dinner, I was sitting next to the president, and I asked the president, you know, what made them pick me? And he nodded at his assistant. And so I asked her, and she said, well, you know, there was this book called maybe something like Geeks with Curves or something like that, and that profiled maybe 50 women with technology careers. And Ryerson was very proud of the fact that they had this master's, basically an MIS master's degree that was maybe 30% female. And they really wanted to have a woman. And so she read this book and picked me as the person she thought was the most interesting to give the honorary doctorate to. And so, then I went through you know, it's sort of a period of time when I was getting an honorary doctorate, it seems like, almost every year. And, of course, you know, there was, of those, I mean, every single one of them is to me, it's a phenomenal, it's just a phenomenal honor, not just because you're getting an honorary doctorate, but because you're actually going to give the commencement speech. And I love giving commencement speeches. And, you know, it's just a phenomenal opportunity. But there were three of the honorary doctorates that were incredibly meaningful to me. The first one was from the University of Alberta, which is, of course, where I received all of my degrees, and I just have this, you know, incredible debt to the University of Alberta. I mean, the folks in the math department gave me a phenomenal education and, you know, were incredible mentors, and I just feel very, very lucky. The second one that was incredibly meaningful was from the University of British Columbia, and, you know, I've already talked about just how, you know, UBC is, it's an institution that's like a jewel. It's just, you know, such an incredibly wonderful institution. And then the third one was the University of Baltimore, Maryland County. And, I'm such an admirer of Freeman Hrabowski. I mean, he's been president there for, I think, 20 years, and he's just absolutely phenomenal. And, we had given Freeman, an honorary doctorate at MUD the year before. And so, you know, like to be given an honorary doctorate by Freeman was just like, that's one of, it's just a very, very special thing. So, you know, I think the thing about, I spend a lot of time these days nominating people for awards. I mean, it's sort of like, there's the phase when you get awards, and then there's the phase when you actually are the person nominating people for awards. And I think it's incredibly important to recognize people who have done, you know, who've made a difference in the world. And so it gives me a lot of pleasure to write nomination letters and to, you know, support nominations in various kinds of ways. And I just think it highlights great work. And, you know, people doing great work are not doing it for the recognition, obviously, because it typically takes a decade's worth of hard work before anyone's going to recognize it. So, but I think it does make a lot of sense to draw attention to it, because I think it inspires others to do great work.
Maria, you're so involved in so many societal impact initiatives, and we talked about some of them here. Now, are there others that you can describe that we haven't discussed?
The main one that I haven't talked about in this series, that was a project that I started when Anita was in her, you know, had reached a point where she really couldn't do much work, and she was suffering. So aphasia is a loss of language, and it can come in many different forms. It can be loss of ability to comprehend, loss of ability to produce oral language, loss of ability to read, loss of ability to write. And it's typically caused by some kind of trauma to the brain. Could be a stroke, or could be, you know, concussion, could be a brain tumor, as in Anita's case. And one of the things that I decided to do in the sort of the final 9 months or so of Anita's life was to start this project so that, in spending time with Anita, I realized that it was very frustrating to her that she couldn't find words for things. She couldn't write, for instance, she couldn't write down the time of an appointment. But on the other hand, she could still read a map, and she could still recognize images and all those kinds of things. And so, the idea was to use, to create a basically multimedia kind of, tools for her that, so for instance, a multimedia calendar. So, you know, so she could see the photograph of her doctor, and a picture of a clock showing 2 o'clock, because these were all things that she could work with. And so, together with three faculty members at UBC, Joanna McGranary, Barbara Purvis, and, oh, I'm getting so old, and a faculty member in psychology whose name will come to me soon, we started this project, and I expected that, you know, I wouldn't continue working on it when I moved to Princeton, and I knew I was moving to Princeton when we started it, but I wanted to start it because I wanted to give it was very hard for Anita, who lived her life with so much purpose in it, to suddenly be not able to do much. And so I felt that if we had the research project work with her, it would give the last few months of her life some real purpose, because she would be helping us understand, you know, what kinds of things would have to go into a design of this kind. And the FASER project ran for probably really about 8 years, with most of that activity in the first 5 years. And I had three graduate students, PhD students, working on things related to the FASER project while I was at Princeton. What we, you know, really discovered, which is, you know, not so surprising, but I don't think was really fully recognized before we started working on it, is that it was very hard to design a system that was going to work for random people, because it turns out that aphasia, as I think with many cognitive disabilities, every individual is different. And so, you know, the ability to design something that would work for somebody with aphasia just was a very challenging project. And I think what would probably happen now is if people were to start working on it again, is it, just because we know so much more about machine learning techniques and data analytics and so on, one would probably try to actually make an adaptive set of system that adapted automatically. The other thing we realized is there's lots of funding for children with speech defects, or, you know, like any kind of speech issue. There's almost no funding for adults. And seeing aphasia is something that typically the kinds of people that you'd want to help are people who've had strokes, because if it's people with a concussion, they will probably recover, and if it's people with a brain tumor, they will probably die. But there's just almost no funding in health insurance to cover the kind of work that people need. And, you know, one of the things that's really sad is that for people who actually have money and can get continuing therapy, they've shown that even after 10 years after a stroke, people can continue to improve. But the vast majority of people get maybe 2 months of speech-language therapist to work with them afterwards. And there's very little funding for devices or software to help them. And so, you know, it ended up being, again, a bit like Silicon Chalk, a research project that was ahead of its time. But I'm optimistic that somebody will manage to do something, you know, sometime. One, devices are so much less expensive. You know, then the kind of devices we needed to work with cost $500. Now it costs, you know, it's basically a smartphone. And, you know, so it's $49.95 with AT&T if you want a Lumia 900, which is the most popular Windows phone.
So, Maria, who are your mentors today, and how do they influence you?
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm very fortunate, first of all, to have, you know, my number one mentor in my life is my husband, and also my, you know, the love of my life, my collaborator, and all kinds of things, but the person who I talk to about pretty much everything. But I'm also very fortunate to have a number of tech leaders who are, you know, either slightly older than me or slightly younger than me, or sometimes quite a bit younger than me, both male and female, that, you know, I talk to about issues a lot. And, you know, the person that I think has really, one person who's had a big impact on me just in the last year, and I've talked about this a bit, is Sheryl Sandberg. And it's one of the things, I consider her a personal friend at this point, and I think she would say the same. But also someone who's, you know, she has a different enough background from mine that, and a different enough career that I learned things from Sheryl that I probably wouldn't learn from another university president. And she's very articulate and thoughtful. And, you know, one of the things Sheryl talks a lot about is leaning forward in your career. And by that she means being ambitious, you know, reaching for that gold ring or brass ring or whatever. And it's not that I have ever been not ambitious, but there are ways that she, there are particular ways that she has framed some questions that have caused me to think about things in somewhat different ways, and I really value that. Another person who I have mentioned is Jennifer Chase, who, you know, like whenever I need to talk about, and whenever I need to think about something really hard that I've, you know, already talked to Nick about, but I want sort of an alternate version or vision of, I will typically talk to Jennifer, I will talk to Tally Whitney, who I've mentioned, and I will talk to Bob Tarjan. So Bob Tarjan, you know, very famous computer scientist, really the person who recruited me to Princeton and one of my dearest friends. And those are three really different people. And another person who I will often talk to is somebody called Avi Victorson, who's another famous computer scientist who is at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton and is Israeli. And what I love, you know, about sort of this group of people is that they're just, and still another one is Ron Graham and Fan Chung. And, you know, these people all have very different perspectives, different set of experiences, and know me well, but think of me as slightly different people. And so they're like, and I probably am a slightly different person because of the roles I play in each of their lives. And so, you know, when I ask them for advice, it's sort of like I'm very definitely getting, you know, like a set of, many different facets. And so it's a great way of getting advice. Other people I talk to, when I'm thinking about mud things, I'd say great sources of inspiration are my vice presidents and Kelly and Karen. And then also, you know, my board chair, Malcolm Lewis, vice chair, Barbara Patoka, and chair of board affairs, Debbie Byron, who are really the trustees that I probably talk to the most often, though I will say I have many trustees on my board whose opinions I value deeply. And, you know, just so, you know, the thing the approach that I tend to take is to try and get people with different personalities and different viewpoints and who know me in different ways and then get them to provide, get them to provide advice, perspective, and it works really well. I also get a lot of advice from my children. My children are very different from each other, and so I get very different advice from them. And Yannick will basically just say, do whatever makes you happy, Mom. And Sasha will be like, so much more prescriptive. Do this, don't do that. You should for sure consider this thing, et cetera, et cetera.
That's interesting. When you describe your children, it makes me smile.
Yeah. They are, well, Yannick is actually visiting on Pender for a couple of days. And
so, Maria, I'm going to roll up a series of questions into one final question, and that is, and you can choose how you want to answer this. So one of the questions is, you're always working on hard questions and challenges. What are they today into the future? So that's one that you could take on. Or from mid-career to the present, what were and are the areas of controversy?
I'm going to do that one for sure.
And then finally, if you were conducting this interview, what sort of questions would you ask, and then what would be your answer? So you can pick amongst those three and how you want to answer them in the remaining minutes.
So let me talk about controversy. So, you know, I have been the first female in my job for the last 24 years. And as you know, I am constantly pushing for more women and under other underrepresented groups. So, I mean, I can be very pushy and, you know, I'm very driven by the things I'm working on. And, you know, sometimes people just get tired of it. While I was at UBC, I was also pushing extremely hard for computer science to be valued as a discipline. And, you know, computer science at different universities can either be in, you know, the college or the faculty of engineering or the college or the faculty of science. And at UBC, for whatever reason, the powerful science departments, which were generally, you know, math, physics, and chemistry, which had been sort of had grown dramatically and had gotten a lot of resources in the 60s, none of them thought that computer science was actually a scientific discipline. I mean, they basically thought it was nothing but programming and that, you know, there was no particular reason to need a computer science department in a faculty of science. And when I was hired to be, you know, head of the computer science department, it was very explicitly with a mission to build the department. And the resources that the university was making available was just, you know, was just not consistent with doing that. And, you know, so for example, our teaching assistant budgets, our equipment budgets were just sort of like tiny. And, you know, less than a tenth of what the chemistry department or the physics department were getting, for the same, on a per student basis. And I fought very hard to get, and, you know, we did manage to get some new funding from the province, but, you know, over the years, there was a fair amount of, as we went through budget cuts, which happened almost every year that I was at UBC, you know, some of the richer departments were getting cut more than others, and our department typically was not being cut and, in fact, was getting resources added to its budget. And that was extraordinarily controversial among the departments who felt, you know, that they were the best, that they were so much better a department than the computer science department. There was no reason to be doing this. And so when I became dean of science, there was a lot of resentment, particularly from physics and chemistry. And they also did not have a lot of women faculty, and, you know, just they did not want a computer scientist as dean, and they certainly did not want to be pushed to hire more female faculty. And, you know, the flip side was that when I was at IBM Research, I was in a, you know, in California, there was no math department, whereas there was a math department at Yorktown Heights. And so I was spending all my time pushing for mathematics to be valued as a discipline in at a research lab that valued physics and material science and computer science, but not mathematics. So, you know, I'd say the things that I do that are controversial is that I'm constantly pushing for change. And I think, become more diplomatic about how I do it. And so I think I'm a much less controversial figure at MUD than I was at UBC. But, you know, I think the thing I've had to learn is, you know, there are better ways to affect change and there are worse ways to affect change. And, you know, if, you know, sometimes you do have to push, but the more you can get where people feel like they're making the change because they want to make the change rather than they're being forced to change, the more likely that the change will actually succeed and last. So if I were conducting the interview, what three questions would I ask? The first one I would ask myself is, why do I love Harriman College so much? And I think I've answered that many, many times, but it's all about the mission and the people and the opportunity to work with such dedicated faculty, students, and staff, trustees, and alumni is just amazing. And, you know, just being able to go into work every day and say, I know what our mission is, I know what we're trying to do, I know what needs to get done. It's got to be one of the clearest times in my life in terms of just having such a focus on it. It's wonderful. Then my second question would be, what would you change in your career choices, if anything? And the one I would change for sure is, I would not, if I had it to do over again, I would not take on the vice president role at UBC because it took too much energy and attention from me at a time when, you know, Sasha was, you know, she was 11 when I started, and maybe she was 10 when I started. But, you know, the years from 10 to 13, which were the years that I did that job, were very important years for her, and I just wasn't able to be present for her in the ways that I wish I could have. Now, you know, it's entirely possible things would have been just as awful if I weren't doing that job, but, I mean, it caused a split in our relationship that is now completely healed, but, you know, she's 27 now, so that's a very long time, and it really has been the last 10 years that it has been healing. And I'm just really grateful for the relationship I have with her today. But if I could have avoided having done that, I would really avoid that. And then my last question is, where's my favorite place in the world? And it's Pender Island in British Columbia, which is where I am right this second.
And I guess here I am, keeping you away.
No, today's my day of phone calls. I have almost nonstop phone calls till 3.
I see. So, well, Maria, again, thank you for coming in today. I know your schedule is demanding, and you're just this world-renowned figure, and you've shared so much of your history and wisdom with the audience, so it's very much appreciated.
Well, I always love talking with you, Stephen.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Dr. Maria Clavey, pioneering world-renowned computer scientist, president of Harvard Mudd College, board director of Microsoft and Broadcom, past keynote speaker, World CIO Forum, past Dean of Engineering and Professor of Computer Science at Princeton University, former Vice President and Dean of Science at the University of British Columbia in Canada. This is the final interview in an interview series where we explored Maria's considerable history from her early years and into her professional life of notable distinction, significant outstanding contributions in a number of fields, including societal causes. In future interviews, we'll continue to follow Maria's outstanding work impacting business, industry, governments, education, and society.